Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you. We are gaining audience every day. I see the emails, the topics you find of importance in your life. And there's one overarching issue that everyone's concerned with who listens. That is empowering you. Empowering to make healthier choices, to live longer lives, empowering for happiness, working together. The future is we, not me. And that's what we're about, as you'll see today. We always like to start with something that everyone can participate in, that is changing some unhealthy habits into healthier habits. For example, today, an ancient Ayurvedic herb boosts memory and multitasking and reduces stress. A new study shows more about apple peel's power, and I'll give you something brand new on apple peels. The Mediterranean diet with nuts and olive oil can reverse metabolic syndrome. That could help about 100 million people in the United States. The World Health Organization says rising energy drink consumption may pose a very serious threat to public health. Amaranth, a gluten-free grain that's so rich in protein and minerals. Most Americans have never heard of amaranth, let alone used it. I remember teaching my first organic course at the Fertiller Farm in 1972. The grain, amaranth. So I'll tell you about amaranth. Then, from our environmental segment today, Iraqi doctors call depleted uranium use genocide. This is very important. This is from someone we've had on the program. In fact, I just had him on last night, or night before last, on Progressive Commentary, Dar Jamail, and from Truthout. Now, I've written about it, spoken about it, but it needs to be put in perspective today. That what no one is taking responsibility for when we go into a country such as Iraq is all those munitions, the bombs, the bullets, the rockets, the drone rockets, they all are made with depleted uranium. And the doctors there, they're saying that's genocide. I'll give you that. Winged warning, built for survival, birds in trouble from pole to pole. Very important piece from Alana Mitchell from Environmental Health News. It's what we're not looking at because we don't see it every day, but those who study it say the ice of Antarctica is making a difference now, and that heat in the tropics are making a difference. The deserts, the swamps, the open ocean, the sheer rock faces, the treeless tundra, all of this is a part of the world of the bird. We don't pay attention. We should, and I'll tell you why on that. If time permits, we'll be having How to Spot a Liar. Now, you may be surprised at how many liars there are, how often they lie, and why they lie. So what if we did this? This is from Pamela Meyer. What if we agreed that for one day in our lives, no matter what the issue or the outcome or the sacrifice or the consequence, we would simply be honest? I'm asking everyone in this audience to do that. That no matter what they're asked, just tell the truth. Don't tell something that's politically correct or something that you hope people will become more comfortable with or to get yourself out of a jam. Just tell the truth. Think that'll be easy? Well, let's see. Because tomorrow I'm going to ask you to call in and tell us the results and how that was different than if you would have spoken with people in a normal way. You'll see why this question I'm asking you is so important when you hear this brilliant discussion by Pamela Meyer a little later on the show. Now, my guest in the second part of our program today, you have not heard before, Professor Charles Rubin. He's a professor of political science at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, where he teaches political philosophy. And he's also visiting professor at Princeton University. We're going to talk about human extinction and the meaning of technological progress. and why we should really pay attention to this, because it may help us in the future, or it may be a part of the problem of the future. That'll be an interesting discussion. Let's begin. I'm going to begin, however, with something that needs to be addressed, and that is so much fear about the Ebola virus and people suggesting all forms of treatments, everything from ozone to different herbs will kill it, stop it, prevent it. What I'll share with you now is what we actually have some reliable science on. As we know, there's a great deal on the internet that is either partial truth, completely non-true, and sometimes fully true. But because I've spent my entire adult life in the healing field, I have a little perspective on this. What I learned once, and this I've never discussed before, but I'll share it with you, is I was in a debate. It was down in Atlanta. I didn't have the credentials, the academic credentials. I was just a concerned consumer activist, and no one else was out there debating, so they invited me to debate, and so I did. I had a best-selling book, and that's why they, you know, I was on Johnny Carson, Merv Griffin, everyone, and Mike Douglas. So they said, well, come on, talk about health, because most of that book that I wrote dealt with environmental problems, DDT, for example, and synthetic cosmetic ingredients, and the antibiotics we were taking. So anyhow, at the end of the debate, the physician who I was debating gave me some advice. He said, look, kid, he said, if you want to do better in debates, it's not about whether what you're telling is the truth or whether you have facts on your side. It's the perception the public has of who is the authority figure. And what makes someone an authority figure is that they have some scientific references on their side. You got to have proof. If you don't have that, you'll lose the debate. And I thought about that. And therefore and thereafter, every time I did a study, I went overboard to document it, to really do documentation. So when I was looking around at all the holistic or supposedly holistic medical practices in New York City, I didn't see them being holistic. They were certainly helping some people, but they were all specialist. Like one person on the Upper West Side would treat you for every single person came in, they would be called low blood sugar. And that's what they would treat you for, hypoglycemia. Didn't matter what your condition. And there were a lot of complaints because people came there who really didn't have that, who were paying outrageous amounts of money to be tested and treated. Or someone else, you had to be on a high protein diet. So in any case, that's why I opened up as a public service, because I never got a penny for myself, the Tri-State Healing Center. First, it was opened up on 84th Street in Riverside Drive in a brownstone. Thousands upon thousands of people came through there, and one thing that was done, every single person was tested and retested to see that if they were being given a protocol, was the protocol working? Now, believe it or not, that was the first time that anyone in the field was actually keeping meticulous records. So if you came in with hepatitis or herpes or any condition, all of your blood chemistry was checked, and then if it wasn't working, it was shifted. If it was, then it was continued. There was no ozone used. It was intravenous vitamins at very high doses. And the physician during the therapy would review the charts with the patient on a regular basis. And I just saw so many people's lives saved and turned around. And I lived upstairs. It was my brownstone. I live in the top two floors, and I had the medical center on the two below me. And so I was up and down those steps all day long, talking with people, sitting with people. It was the clean diet, getting them off all processed foods, getting off all inflammatory foods, detoxifying them, juices, lots of wheatgrass juice, chelating them with natural chelating agents, but some had to use a more powerful EDTA, ethylene diamine tetracetic acid, to get the heavy metals out, to get their mercury, lead, cadmium levels down, and then help their liver, cleanse that thin the blood naturally, so they have a healthier blood. But in time, and it wasn't overnight, it would sometimes take a year, year and a half, 2 years, you could see complete turnaround, 100% success, and the medical studies records to prove it. And we invited people, doctors, nurses, scientists, to come in and observe. I wanted everyone to be aware that there was a new paradigm being used. And so thousands of people were improved. From there, because it was such cramped quarters, moved down to 72nd Street and were there for 6 years. And again, thousands of people using holistic protocols. There is no such thing as a single magic bullet. I've never seen it. It is a combination of multiple therapies, sometimes 20, 30, or 40 therapies used over a period of time that causes the entire body chemistry to be strengthened, the immune system strengthened, and the body allowed to engage in natural healing. So when it comes to Ebola, and I hear all the claims being made, I'm concerned, because where's the science? If you're going to do it right, what you do is you take a therapy, whatever you're promoting, if it's a homeopathic, if it's an herb, it's a supplement, if it's ozone, and you first do your basic research. You get the virus or bacteria, if you were manifesting a research on a bacteria, and you test it and you show repeatedly how many times you can impact the in vitro, later you do in vivo, and you show how many viruses you were able to kill, what percentage, how long did it take, at what power, what dosage. Then you publish that results, and others can come in and take that and take it further to verify it. That's the proper way it's done. And then you get a group of people together, and you have independent scientists who then use that therapy and see if they're able to get the results in humans. The key is it should not be toxic, and it should have efficacy in background. If you make any claims beyond that, then you are putting yourself out there with no support. Here's what we know now about the Ebola virus and what should be considered viable. Homeopathic spider venom, vitamin C, fermented soy, all hold promise as anti-Ebola virus therapies. All could be used together because they have all been shown in peer-reviewed literature to be able to impact viruses. I'll share some specifics with you now from Sarah G., and we appreciate the research on this. In fact, I just spoke with a physician last night who said, I know you keep all the science on this. What can help the Ebola? I said, well, go to the journal, peer-reviewed journal, highly respected Archives of Virology. There is an article entitled Inhibition of Lassa Virus and Ebola Virus Infection in Host Cells Treated with Kinase Inhibitors, Genistein, and Trifostin. It was done at the University of Texas Medical Branch, and they looked at the therapeutic role of two so-called kinase inhibitors in interfering with Ebola virus. The one is the plant compound genistein, G-E-N-I-S-T-E-I-N, and the other is the pharmaceutical drug called Trifostin, T-Y-R-O-P-H-O-S-T-I-N. Now, the author referenced different animal studies showing genistein was able to reduce harm from infection from a virus that causes Ebola-like viral hemorrhagic fever in hamsters, namely the Pichindi virus, the PICV virus. And the quote from the article, infection of hamsters with the PIVRV produces VHS manifestations, including inflammation, lesions in various organs, core temperature increase, weight loss, viremia, petechial rash, hemorrhage, and mortality. Treating the animals with the kinase inhibitor genistein led to a, quote, significant increase in survival and the amelioration of the VHS disease signs. And so, therefore, the study served, quote, as a proof of concept for using kinase inhibitor as a therapeutic or prophylactic in animal model, end quote. The researchers found good information on genistein and triphosphatin's ability to inhibit viral entry of various viruses known to cause hemorrhagic fever, including Ebola, Marburg virus, the MARV, and vascular tomostitis virus, and the Lassa virus. And proteins of these four viruses were engineered to be expressed by a special type of virus. So they found that, quote, the genistein, that's from soy, and triphosphatin individually inhibit the entry of these viruses into the cells, both through interfering with endocytosis, and that means the process by which a cell pulls in a virus, and uncoating proteins, that's the process by which a virus alters proteins on the surface of the host cell to gain entry. It was also observed that the synergistic effect occurred when genistein and triphosphatin were added together. Quote, and all these data demonstrate that infection of host cells with the MARV and Ebola and arenovirus, Lassa, is inhibited when cells are pretreated with genistein or triphosphatin, AG1478. In both cases, the inhibition was found to be concentration dependent. So, that's what we know. We also know that there's an index of over 150 health benefits of genistein across 50 mapped physiological pathways in the biological literature. You can view them by going to evidence-based genistein benefits. Quote, genistein, by far the most studied soy isoflavone in this regard, and has been shown to inhibit the infectivity of enveloped and non-enveloped viruses, as well as single-stranded or double-stranded RNA and DNA viruses, concentrations ranging from physiologic to supraphysiological flavonoids, including genistein, have been shown to reduce the infectivity of a variety of viruses affecting humans and animals, including herpes simplex, human immunodeficiency virus, porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome virus, rotavirus, and adenovirus. So that is the good science. So what you have is you have good science published in peer-reviewed literature showing that that is one of the nutrients that should be considered. Then you have the what is called Garcinia cola, G-A-R-C-I-N-I-A, cola, K-O-L-A. It was reported extracts from the seeds of this traditional African medicinal herb were found to, quote, inhibit this virus, meaning Ebola, in cell culture at non-toxic concentrations. Okay, that's a separate study. Three, vitamin C. According to Dr. Robert Cathcart, M.D., who had the most extensive experience with vitamin C infusion of any physician in American history, and I knew Robert Cathcart very well, we worked together all the time, and the highest he'd ever taken vitamin C intravenous was 50,000, and when I was showing him the results we were getting by reversing all physiological viremia conditions in people with manifesting AIDS symptoms, he upped it higher. We were taking it up to 200,000 milligrams, and after 16 months, we had 9 out of 9 people in the study reported and showed blood chemistries, and we must have had 50 blood chemistries from one of the best blood labs in America. No viral activity. They tested HIV negative at the last test and have stayed such. So anyhow, Robert Cathcart, quote, the Ebola virus kills by way of free radicals, which can be neutralized by massive doses of sodium ascorbate intravenously. Indeed, Ebola virus disease, as is the case with viral hemorrhagic disease in general, resembles features of acute scurvy, and vitamin C is well known to have broad range benefits, including immune boosting and antiviral properties. So I would definitely include vitamin C intravenous as one of the potential therapeutic models. And then there was a very good study that explored the therapeutic potential of a homeopathic preparation of the six-eyed spider venom, what is called Sicarius, S-I-C-A-R-I-U-S, at treating symptoms associated with Ebola virus. And then there's even one on estradiol. There was an analysis from a journal, quote, entitled A Systematic Screen of FDA-Approved Drugs for Inhibitors of Biological Threat Agents, found that estradiol exhibited anti-Ebola virus activity in vitro, indicating the relevance of hormonal factors and perhaps gender in susceptibility to the disease. Now, that's only a small sampling, but at least it shows you that something could be done that currently is not being done, and trying to do a new drug that's really only going to benefit the manufacturers, in my opinion, is not where we should be going. I believe that that you should have a independent group of scientists review multiple approaches and have those who have been infected treated on a holistic protocol in their country of origin, and then look at the results after you've had maybe 500 to 1,000 people treated over a period of 6 months with follow-up. Then and only then are you going to see what really works. And that's my input. And by the way, I have spoken with the medical directors, the heads of their entire medical community in the Sudan and other African countries, to try to give them insight on this very important issue. Next up, amaranth. A gluten-free grain rich in protein and minerals. First, what is good about it is it has a very mild taste. So it's really the seasoning that gives it its uniqueness. If you want to chop up some Swiss chard and put in some peppers and some spinach and some garlic, it's going to taste very savory. So it's going to take on any flavor you want. You could even use it as a breakfast cereal in the morning. And dice up some apples and bananas and put some berries in there. It's a complete protein. It contains all 8 essential amino acids. It's just as healthy in its protein profile as meat without all the dangers of eating meat. You're getting 13 to 19% protein, which is good. And that's right there with rice and sorghum and rye. And has lots of lysine. That's missing in a lot of grains in any percentage that's important. It's gluten-free, unlike quinoa and buckwheat. Amaranth is naturally gluten-free, and it's good for your cardiovascular system. There was an article published in Lipids and Health and Disease that found that amaranth oil could benefit patients with coronary artery disease, and a new research in the protein science found that amaranth could potentially treat atherosclerosis narrowing the arteries. It's a really good source of fiber. You're getting about 5 grams of fiber in a single cup, which is a serving. It's got lots of minerals. Magnesium is very good in there. Phosphorus is good. And manganese, calcium, potassium, zinc, copper, and selenium. All good for you. Amaranth, you can also find as a cold-pressed oil, as a flour, and all of that is good for you. The World Health Organization says, hold on a second to all those energy drinks, because they're not good for you. The research was published in the journal Frontiers in Public Health, and it says, increasing consumption of energy drinks has caused an increase in adverse health effects. Last year, a report from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration revealed that the number of emergency department visits involving energy drinks doubled to 20,783. Who would have figured that 20,000 people end up in an emergency room because of an energy drink? Why? Excess caffeine. Caffeine's the main ingredient. You're getting, in a single little container, 500 milligrams of caffeine. That's equivalent to 5 cups of coffee. And I know people that will go out for a workout on a Sunday and have 2 or 3 of these. It's dangerous. Stay away from them, because you have no idea what that's doing to your heart, blood pressure, can cause heart palpitations, nausea, vomiting, psychoses, convulsions, even death. And if you drink energy drinks and alcohol, wow, terrible combination. Quote, the consumption of high amounts of caffeine contained within energy drinks reduces drowsiness without diminishing the effect of alcohol, resulting in a state of wide-awake drunkenness, keeping the individual awake longer with the opportunity to continue drinking. Not a good idea. And finally, the Mediterranean diet with nuts and olive oil may reverse metabolic syndrome. This is from the Canadian Medical Association Journal. It says, quote, metabolic syndrome could be reversed by following a Mediterranean diet with extra virgin olive oil and nuts. Metabolic syndrome, this audience knows, you have three or more risk factors for cardiovascular disease or diabetes. If you're overweight, if you have high cholesterol, if you have high blood pressure or high blood sugar, you got metabolic syndrome. And 34% of all adults in the United States have metabolic syndrome. Because we're overweight, we're obese, we lack physical activity, and that puts us at great risk. So, the good news is, grains, vegetables, seeds, nuts, legumes, juices, and give up the red meat, fish, poultry, processed foods, and you could be saving your life. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest in health and nutrition. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you from all over the world. And you can always listen to this program if you're out and about over your telephone. And by the way, most of the young people listening today are not listening by a land-based station. They're listening and watching this program over their telephones and their iPads and their portable electronic devices. You can listen by going to this phone number, 712-432-7231, 712-432-7231. We're about to pass 12 million minutes listened. Wow, it's a lot of people listening over the telephone. A few program announcements before we're going to play a little bit, not all of Pamela Myers' How to Spot a Liar, then we'll go to our guest. But we have a lot going on. Here are some of the announcements. This Saturday at 3 p.m. at our offices, I'll be having a workshop not on how to survive a solar storm. I've done four of those to about 3,000 people. No, this is free. This is a public service. This is for those people who realize, as I do, that a solar storm is inevitable and would like to have a support system so that when it does happen, wherever you're at, you'll know what to do. So you have a network of people, one or two or five, so you can work with each other. And there's a lot to that, so that you're not just stuck thinking, I should have listened, I didn't, I never thought it would happen, it is, what do I do? So it's not a lecture on how to survive a solar storm. Rather, it's for those people who want to network with other people to help them know where to go and what to do. If you want to come, you'll have to call. Room is limited, 646-926-5422. This Saturday, I'll also be interviewing for personal assistance. And something new, we're going to be using interim producers, meaning I did this in the 1980s for about 5 years, and it was very successful. We have so many specials that we're going to do. We're going to be bringing in a producer per special. And to work on one special at a time, we have like 30 different things we're going to do specials on that we'll be broadcasting. If you'd like to be considered for that, you'll call that same number. Also, we're starting a new film festival, and it'll be premiering next August, it'll be the first international progressive documentary film festival, where just like the Sundance and the Toronto, and we're going to have only documentaries and only progressive documentaries, and it'll be in New York. But I'm looking for someone to help lead that, and I'll be meeting with people on Saturday at noon on that as well. So that's that. Let me also mention that as a fundraiser for our sister station, WBAI, trying to help this wonderful station financially, I am making the premiere of my new feature film, which will be premiering December 5th in Los Angeles and in New York City at the Quad. 35 showings, all in 1 week, five in a day. I'll be there each evening. For those who want to come, you're going to get two copies of the film, one to you for you to keep and one to give to others, plus a hardback book, A Living in the Moment, $120 value. It's $30, and we are filling up. So once it's filled, it's full. And unfortunately, the Quad is not a giant theater. I've done screenings, as you know, and premieres with a 1,000-seat theater down on Broadway, but this is one of them. So if you want to join me for the premiere of Poverty, Inc., a very powerful film, the most comprehensive, powerful film on poverty and what really causes it and who's behind it and what we can do to overcome it, what we the people have to know, the lies we've been told, who's told them, how do we get into this mess? The lobbyists, the politicians, the special interest groups, how they've worked it, and it's not just here, it's worldwide. I filmed all over the world. Give a call. The number is 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. This is a fundraiser for WBAI. We look forward to seeing you there. But please, for those of you who've gone to the Ethical Culture Center over the last 6 years, when I've had six showings there, that's 1,000 seats. Every seat's been taken, people have been standing. This is a smaller venue, so we're filling it up, and I want to make sure those who care about poverty and its solutions and helping people, all people, you'll need to watch this. Everyone you could imagine is in here. Poverty, Inc., world premiere. We're qualifying for the Academy Awards December 5th through the 11th in Manhattan. I'll be there for both showings at night, but we have five showings a day. Call 877-627-5065. 5065. Now let's hear a few minutes from Pamela Meyer on how to spot a liar.
Okay, now I don't want to alarm anybody in this room, but it's just come to my attention that the person to your right is a liar. Also, the person to your left is a liar. Also, the person sitting in your very seats is a liar. We're all liars. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to show you what the research says about why we're all liars, how you can become a lie spotter, and why you might want to go the extra mile and go from lie spotting to truth seeking, and ultimately to trust building. Now, speaking of trust, ever since I wrote this book, Lie Spotting, no one wants to meet me in person anymore. No, 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 no. They say, it's okay. We'll email you. I can't even get a coffee date at Starbucks. My husband's like, honey, deception. Maybe you could have focused on cooking. How about French cooking? So before we get started, what I'm going to do is I'm going to clarify my goal for you, which is not to teach a game of gotcha. Lie spotters aren't those nitpicky kids, those kids in the back of the room that are shouting, gotcha, gotcha, your eyebrow twitched, you flared your nostril, I watched that TV show, lie to me, I know you're lying. No. Lie spotters are armed with scientific knowledge of how to spot deception. They use it to get to the truth, and they do what mature leaders do every day. They have difficult conversations with difficult people, sometimes during very difficult times. And they start up that path by accepting a core proposition. And that proposition is the following. Lying is a cooperative act. Think about it. A lie has no power whatsoever by its mere utterance. Its power emerges when someone else agrees to believe the lie. So I know it may sound like tough love, but look, if at some point you got lied to, It's because you agreed to get lied to. Truth number one about lying. Lying's a cooperative act. Now, not all lies are harmful. Sometimes we're willing participants in deception for the sake of social dignity, maybe to keep a secret that should be kept secret, secret. We say, nice song. Honey, you don't look fat in that, no. Or we say, favorite of the digerati. You know, I just fished that email out of my spam folder. I'm so sorry. But there are times when we are unwilling participants in deception, and that can have dramatic costs for us. Last year saw $997 billion in corporate fraud alone in the United States. That's an eyelash under $1 trillion. That's 7% of revenues. Deception can cost billions. Think Enron, Madoff, the mortgage crisis, or in the case of double agents and traitors like Robert Hansen or Aldrich Ames. Lies can betray our country. They can compromise our security. They can undermine democracy. They can cause the deaths of those that defend us. Deception is actually serious business. This con man, Henry Oberlander, he was such an effective con man. British authorities say he could have undermined the entire banking system of the Western world. And you can't find this guy on Google. You can't find him anywhere. He was interviewed once, and he said the following. He said, look, I've got one rule. And this was Henry's rule. He said, look, everyone is willing to give you something. They're ready to give you something for whatever it is they're hungry for. And that's the crux of it. If you don't want to be deceived, you have to know, what is it that you're hungry for? And we all kind of hate to admit it. You know, we kind of wish we were better husbands, better wives, smarter, more powerful, taller, richer. The list goes on. Lying is an attempt to bridge that gap, to connect our wishes and our fantasies about who we wish we were, how we wish we could be, with what we're really like. And boy, are we willing to fill in those gaps in our lives with lies. On a given day, studies show that you may be lied to anywhere from 10 to 200 times. Now, granted, many of those are white lies. But in another study, it showed that strangers lied 3 times within the first 10 minutes of meeting each other. Now, when we first hear this data, we recoil. We can't believe how prevalent lying is. We're essentially against lying. But if you look more closely, the plot actually thickens. We lie more to strangers than we lie to coworkers. Extroverts lie more than introverts. Men lie 8 times more about themselves than they do other people. Women lie more to protect other people. If you're in an average married couple, you're going to lie to your spouse in 1 out of every 10 interactions. Now, you may think that's bad. If you're unmarried, that number drops to 3. Lying's complex. It's woven into the fabric of our daily and our business lives. We're deeply ambivalent about the truth. We parse it out on an as-needed basis, sometimes for very, very good reasons, and other times just because we don't understand the gaps in our lives. That's truth number 2 about lying. We're against lying, but we're covertly for it in ways that our society has sanctioned for centuries and centuries and centuries. It's as old as breathing. It's part of our culture. It's part of our history. Think Dante, Shakespeare, the Bible, News of the World. Lying has evolutionary value to us as a species. Researchers have long known that the more intelligent the species, the larger the neocortex, the more likely it is to be deceptive. Now, you might remember Coco. Does anybody here remember Coco the gorilla, who was taught sign language? Coco was taught to communicate via sign language. Here's Coco with her kitten. It's her cute little fluffy pet kitten. Coco once blamed her pet kitten for ripping a sink out of the wall. We're hardwired to become leaders of the pack. It starts really, really early. How early? Well, babies will fake a cry, pause, wait to see who's coming, and then go right back to crying. 1-year-olds learn concealment. 2-year-olds bluff. 5-year-olds lie outright. They manipulate via flattery. 9-year-olds, masters of the cover-up. By the time you enter college, you're going to lie to your mom in 1 out of every 5 interactions. By the time we enter this work world, and we're breadwinners, we enter a world that is just cluttered with spam, fake digital friends, partisan media, ingenious identity thieves, world-class Ponzi schemers, a deception epidemic. In short, what one author calls a post-truth society. It's been very confusing for a long time now. What do you do? Well, there are steps we can take to navigate our way through the morass. Trained lie spotters get to the truth 90% of the time. The rest of us, we're only 54% accurate. Why is it so easy to learn? Well, they're good liars and they're bad liars. They're no real original liars. We all make the same mistakes. We all use the same techniques. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you two patterns of deception, and then we're going to look at the hot spots and see if we can find them ourselves. We're going to start with speech.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.
Okay, what were the telltale signs? Well, first we heard what's known as a non-contracted denial. Studies show that people who are overdetermined in their denial will resort to formal rather than informal language. We also heard distancing language, that woman. We know that liars will unconsciously distance themselves from their subject using language as their tool. Now, if Bill Clinton had said, well, they tell you the truth, or Richard Nixon's favorite, in all candor, he would have been a dead giveaway for any lie spotter that knows that qualifying language, as it's called, qualifying language like that, further discredits the subject. Now, if he had repeated the question in its entirety, or if he had peppered his account with a little too much detail, and we're all really glad he didn't do that, he would have further discredited himself. Freud had it right. Freud said, look, there's much more to it than speech. No mortal can keep a secret. If his lips are silent, he chatters with his fingertips, and we all do it. No matter how powerful you are, we all chatter with our fingertips. I'm going to show you Dominique Strauss-Kahn with Obama, who's chattering with his fingertips. Now, this brings us to our next pattern, which is body language. With body language, here's what you got to do. You really got to just throw your assumptions out the door. Let the science temper your knowledge a little bit. Because we think liars fidget all the time. Well, guess what? They're known to freeze their upper bodies when they're lying. We think liars won't look in the eyes. Well, guess what? They look you in the eyes a little too much just to compensate for that myth. We think warmth and smiles convey honesty, sincerity, but a trained lie spotter can spot a fake smile a mile away. Can you all spot the fake smile here? You can consciously contract the muscles in your cheeks, but the real smile's in the eyes. The crow's feet of the eyes, they cannot be consciously contracted.
Now, that is just a little bit of Pamela Meyer talking about how to spot a liar. And you can watch the entire discussion on my website or on my Facebook page. And here is the message. For the next 24 hours, no matter what the circumstance, the sacrifice, just simply be honest, at least as honest as you know honest to be. In other words, don't sugarcoat anything, just tell the truth with the people you're relating to and see what the outcome is, what happens because of that. And then tomorrow we'll have a segment I'll set aside where you can call in and share what it means to be honest. The other day I was brutally honest with my class that I'm doing right now on who are diabetic and all about Are good people doing bad things? Are smart people doing stupid things? And I said, no, stupid people do stupid things and bad people do bad things in the moment they're doing it. Now, they can turn around and do smart things or do good things another moment, but the idea that somehow we're too smart to make those stupid choices or we're too good to make those bad choices simply isn't true. These are the lies we tell ourselves. So I think it's time that we just stopped all this and took an honest look. Did the Democrats really represent liberal values or corporate values? Do the Republicans represent conservative values or corporate values? You know, everywhere we look, we're being lied to. And she said it right. We have to accept the lie to be a part of it. So let's think about that. Now let's go over to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We're standing by as Professor Charles Rubin. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, where he teaches political philosophy. I mentioned this early in the program. And also, he is the author of Eclipse of Man, Human Extinction and the Meaning of Progress. His writings appear in the New Atlantis and where he has been a contributing editor, and his blog is futurism.thenewatlantis.com. Nice to have you with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Today we're told incessantly that new technologies will improve human conditions and protect us in the future, increase our lifespans. And these new technologies are supposed to bring more leisure in our lives, such as with robotics. And we'll have food aplenty with genetically modified crops, and there'll be new vaccines for just about every health condition, and new nanomedicines, more durable products, a new generation of weapons that could make soldiers on the ground obsolete. So far, the promises in all these, in every endeavor, have fallen far short of their expectations. Then there's another technological community, extremely funded, that hopes for a new kind of future humanity that will transcend human limitations and transform humans into another kind of creature that brings together human biology, genetic engineering, computers, and robotic technologies. And while these have been common themes in science fiction novels and movies going way back, there is today a possibility that this transhuman technological movement could achieve some of its goals at some level. So please begin by outlining for us a few of the areas where this movement is showing some success, and in the transhumanist larger vision, describe what a post-human would be like.
Well, let me start at the end, if I may, and talk about what a post-human would be like, and then we can see where at present the movement may be gaining some kind of success. The idea behind that post-human aspiration is that nature created us with all kinds of flaws, you know, from great to small, a small one. How come there's that blind spot in our eye, right? You know, that's just bad design. How come we need to eat so often? How come we need to sleep? Think of all the time we waste sleeping. How come we need to excrete, right? What an unpleasant process that is. How come we get sick so quickly and we're so relatively fragile? All of these questions, according to today's transhumanists, have answers, and they all point back to the same thing, that we're just this kind of randomly generated product of natural processes. Instead of that, they propose, we can take hold of the evolutionary future and redesign human beings so that they don't have these kinds of defects, so that we can really use our intelligence to overcome the flaws that nature has built into us. And you do that using exactly the kind of technologies you've already mentioned. There's a role for genetic engineering, perhaps. There's a role for nanotechnology, robotics, and information technology. All of these things allow us to imagine ways in which we could make human beings better. But, of course, at a certain point, you have made them so much better, you've overcome so many of these supposed flaws, that they aren't really human anymore. And that's how you get from transhumanism to posthumanism, that the redesigned human being will not really be a human being. We will relate to that future created being in the same way as, you know, we relate to our genetic our evolutionary precursors, something different, something that will have abilities far superior to anything we have. So that's the big picture. If we look at that big picture, then we see that, you know, we're not yet all that close to achieving these kinds of capacities. That doesn't stop somebody like Ray Kurzweil, who is chief engineer at Google now, from saying that he expects we'll be able to do this sort of thing on a time scale of decades. You know, not centuries, decades. Because what he sees is something that, you know, we all tend to observe more or less. He sees an accelerating rate of technological change. And that acceleration of the rate of technological change is what makes it plausible for him to believe that, you know, the kinds of abilities to manipulate our bodies, to redesign our bodies, to replace our bodies with mechanical parts, all of this just can come together into a complete rethinking of what it means to be human. Now, having said that, again, all you have to do is look at some recent headlines, and you see things that are pointing in this kind of direction. The gentleman, I think it was in England, who had a cells transplanted into his spine, who was unable to walk, who is now able to walk. People who have implants, who have lost the ability to use their limbs, who are quadriplegic, who can now, by their thoughts, connect with computers, use those computers, and use robotic arms that are linked to those computers. We are just at the edge, apparently, of artificial limbs that will actually be able to transmit feelings to the brain and make them that much more like, real limbs. So you have ongoing developments like these. They have nothing to do with transhumanism as such. Nobody's pursuing these things in order to produce a post-human, but they are creating the potential, despite that, to use such advances for this purpose.
I appreciate those overviews. Thank you. I'm going to bring together two issues, if you would address them, please. In about 6 weeks from now, I'll be going out to Las Vegas to meet with about 7,000 to 9,000 scientists from around the world, where I'll be one of the keynote presenters on a paper on how I was able, in a very controlled way, over 12 months, meeting weekly, reverse virtually all menopausal symptoms in a group of 287 women.
Wow.
That will be the only study of that type. All the other studies, because I've been to many of these scientific conferences because I've done 40 clinical studies, they will be talking about exactly what you're discussing now. If they only had millions more of research to do different types of, let's say, mechanical or research on helping the body with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or heart disease, and yet right now in front of us, not just with the study I'm doing, but with the Mediterranean diet and with meditation and with biofeedback and with mind-body medicine and psychoneuroimmunology, we have thousands and thousands of studies and examples by the millions of people who are able to improve the quality of their life, overcome major disease, and do what no one thought they could do without the mechanistic approach that some of the people involved in the kind of the utopian idealism, and I'm not faulting these people by their so-called idealism, but the fact that they had this utopian idealism, they're not looking at what we already have and could be using now, not decades from now. Your thoughts?
Well, I agree. I'm impressed with your results, and you know much more about this aspect of things than I do, but I would certainly think that there's a rich reservoir of accumulated human knowledge and experience that can be very illuminating if we're actually willing to pay serious attention to it. The disinclination to do so is very powerful because we are caught up in a very different kind of paradigm for how to deal with human ills. And this goes very deep in our culture. I mean, this goes back to Francis Bacon. This goes back to René Descartes. This goes back to really the founding fathers, if you will, of modern science and technology, who saw nature as something to be manipulated for human purposes. And that trajectory then informs subsequent developments, subsequent expectations, so that we tend to think in terms of external interventions rather than looking at the ways in which, you know, by our own actions and by our own mental attitudes, we can work on ourselves. Can I put this another way?
Yes.
Working on ourselves is sometimes very hard, right?
Yes.
It requires a certain kind of discipline. It requires consistency. And these things are always in short supply. So if you live in a world where you have a choice between those more difficult things and the easier things, like taking a pill, it's not surprising that most people are going to take the path that seems to have least resistance to it. But, you know, would it be better for them in all kinds of ways if they attempted working on oneself, if they attempted that kind of mental and physical discipline? I'm confident just from what little I know, and it sounds like knowing much more you're confident, it would be better for them.
I just feel that we have so many people throughout history who've made so many important contributions to how we can live a longer and healthier life that we shouldn't just be looking at a mechanistic way. I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't be doing the research to help with stem cells if it can help a body. I'm saying that we have never been anything but shunned, denied, excoriated, excluded, and kicked to the curb, so that all the good work that thousands of people in the field have done, there's 88,000 licensed holistic practitioners in the United States today. I'll bet the average scientist or physician, public health official, or journalist couldn't name five. And no money goes to them, no respect goes to them. And I just wish that there could be some sense of balance between the futurisms that you talk about and write about and the humanism. Because if you exclude humanism and spiritual values from the utopian idealism that drives this post-human effort, I think that we create an enormous divide. Your final thoughts?
I think that there is much in our culture that leads us to a superficial view of human life. There's much in our culture that, in a way, dehumanizes. And it's to some degree an uphill battle in order to overcome those tendencies. For me, seeing the projections of transhumanism and posthumanism is a kind of motivator to overcome those tendencies. In other words, if this is what the future really promises us, if this is what we're supposed to be working for, then all the more is there reason to take seriously alternative futures which start from a very different conception of human possibilities and human limits.
I appreciate that final thought. I'm going to invite you back when you have an opportunity and would like to come back to talk about the issues concerning post-humanism and the movements such as Kurzweil's Singularity Movement that you feel are urgent for our listeners to hear. So if you have time, would like to come back, we'd love to have a continuing conversation with
you. It would be my pleasure. Contact me and we'll make all the necessary arrangements.
Then we will, and we'll set aside an hour to put it on the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
From Pittsburgh, from Duquesne University, Professor Charles Rubin, Human Extinction and the Meaning of Technological Progress. We just opened the door. I will set aside an hour for us to explore it in greater depth on an upcoming program. I want to thank you all for listening. Go to the website for any information you need. We post over 100 articles a day on progressive themes from some of the finest minds around the world, always showing the solutions to many of our problems. Have a nice day, everyone. And now in studio, and she'll be lecturing Saturday at 1 o'clock here in our office to about 50 people at a time, is Eutrice Lee. Make a call at 646-926-5422 to join Eutrice. Hi, Eutrice.
Hello, Gary. How are you?
Good. I'm going to run upstairs because I got a two-hour pitching to help the station.
We have to improve this relationship. Every time I see you, you're running away from me. What's going on?
What are you going to talk about today?
Well, today we're talking about the media coverage of the impending or the much-anticipated grand jury decision in Ferguson and how they are undermining justice, essentially.
Eutrice Lee, right now, and don't forget to call to join her on Saturday, 646-926-5422, 83rd and Broadway. You got to have a reservation to get in.